This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. Academics struggle with some pretty big questions depending on their field. Philosophers, for example, might ask, why does anything matter? While for physicists like Dave Goldberg, the question is, why is there matter? Goldberg studies and teaches cosmology at Drexel University in Philadelphia, but when he's not teaching undergraduates, he's trying to make this material comprehensible to everyone. Goldberg is the author of the recent book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. Lake Effect's Bonnie North reached Goldberg by phone and asked him about one of the most curious ideas he raises, that we owe our existence to a minus sign.
I think one of the things that people are often surprised by when they learn about science, when they learn about the laws of physics, they see one thing happen after another, and everything sort of seems deterministic, like one of these classic Rube Goldberg machines. But I think one of the problems is that we don't realize how much the universe seems to be fighting against our very existence. And I'll give you an example, the one you're alluding to, which has to do with something that we see called antimatter. We're able to generate it in the lab. People have heard about it from science fiction. It sounds very dangerous because antimatter, when it comes in contact with ordinary matter, completely annihilates. And so one of the strange and sort of surprising things is that in many respects, antimatter is almost exactly the same as ordinary matter, to the degree that if we turned all of your atoms into anti-atoms, as long as we did the same thing to the rest of the universe, then we just wouldn't know the difference. Physics behaves exactly the same.
Okay.
But there's another important part to this. I said that matter and antimatter annihilate. They annihilate completely, one atom for every anti-atom and so on. But we create them the same way. Every time we've been able to create a particle, we create its antiparticle at the same time. So the big question is, if we always create them in equal quantities and we always destroy them in equal quantities, why haven't they completely canceled each other out in the first few seconds after the Big Bang? Why are we left? Why is there matter at all? So matter and antimatter form this great symmetry in the universe, but it turns out that it's not quite perfect. So this little tiny, and it's literally one part in a billion, this little tiny distinction, one we've never been able to directly replicate in a lab, between matter and antimatter, is literally all that allows you to exist, because otherwise we would have been completely annihilated. There are no anti-people. There are no anti-galaxies, as near as we can tell. There's just us, this tiny little extra bit, basically, in the universe.
So that broken symmetry is something that, again, as I was reading the book, and I am not a physicist, I'm not a scientist, coming to it just out of interest and trying to understand better, you know, the universe that we live in, it seems that broken symmetry is required in a lot of different places in order for, as you say, for things to happen.
That's right. So, I mean, I've already mentioned the symmetry, the asymmetry with regards to matter and antimatter. There's another one that's, I think, important and really surprising, which is that, for the most part, if you do an experiment on a microscopic scale, and you look at all the interactions of particles, and you take a little movie of it, if you run that movie in reverse, basically the flow of time going in the opposite direction, that movie looks perfectly valid. The physics looks perfectly fine. And this points to something really kind of weird. As far as the laws of physics are concerned, there is no arrow of time. The laws of physics don't intrinsically know about what is the future and what is the past. So there's a symmetry there, too. And yet, we clearly know that the future and the past are different, just like we know that matter and antimatter are different, and we're the one and not the other. We know which one is the future and not the past. There's a different sort of symmetry breaking, one that we understand, at least, in sort of a very basic way that comes from something known as the second law of thermodynamics, which basically is the idea that things get more complicated over time, or things fall apart, or things become more disordered. And so the big, I guess, fundamental question, one we do not have the answer to, is it that things become more complicated over time, or does the arrow of time go in the direction in which things get more complicated? And we honestly don't know the answer to that.
Do we have any best guesses?
Yeah, a lot of people have best guesses. Unfortunately, for the most part, they generally tend to pick one or the other. Some very, very smart people think that the flow of time, the direction of the flow of time, is caused by the increase in entropy. I must say, I don't share that view. I tend to believe that the direction of the arrow of time is something that's inherent, and then it so happens that entropy increases with time. Entropy is this disorder that I talked about earlier. The reason that entropy increases with time is it's something that's just very, very likely to. You know, you start off with coins, for example. They can either be on heads or tails, and if I have 100 of them, and they're all initially set to heads, and I come along randomly and just start flipping them over one at a time without looking, as time goes on, they'll get distributed more and more, 50-50 heads and tails. They'll become essentially more uniform. Basically, it will increase in entropy. But that's just random chance. So when we're told, you know, in our introductory physics classes that there's this thing called the second law of thermodynamics, the reality is it's actually just a very, very good suggestion, not really a law. It's something that's incredibly likely to happen, that entropy will increase with time. For my money, since it's just something that's very likely to increase with time, ridiculously likely, with many, 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 many zeros, since it's just something that's very likely to increase with time, it's hard for me to imagine a scenario in which time itself is governed by the increase in entropy.
Okay. Well, and telling the stories, one of the things that you talk about in the book are black holes, and you talk about positioning our Alice on the edge of the event horizon on the black hole. And, you know, a lot of us, particularly those of us who love science fiction and, you know, do popular science reading and that sort of thing, you know, love the idea of black holes and want to understand them. And, oh, you know, everything gets sucked into a black hole and that there's all kinds of fun stuff. But you take that and you play with that. And yet after reading that chapter, I understood so much better what's happening at the event horizon, just before the event horizon, in the black hole itself. And I think maybe you're onto something.
Well, first of all, thank you. Those are very kind words. Secondly, for your listeners, you mentioned Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass come up a lot in this book because, of course, Lewis Carroll played around a lot with the idea of how things look in the mirror, obviously, but also how things look in just slightly different worlds where you change the rules seemingly ever so slightly, and played around with games like chess, but plays around with those ideas of these symmetric games and flipping things around. So Alice ends up being a proxy a lot of the time. But it's absolutely true that you know, trying to sort of imagine yourself in circumstances like falling into a black hole, or how that would appear, or why it would appear that way, and why falling into a black hole really isn't that different than a lot of the physics that we experience every day. It's just more extreme. I think that's a perspective that many people might not have seen before. One of the heroes, in fact, probably the hero of this book, is a little-known mathematician named Emmy Noether.
Yes, and I was going to bring up Emmy Noether because she is probably someone that most of us haven't heard of. I certainly hadn't before I read your book, and it seems that what she did was contributed in a fundamental way to our understanding of physics in the 21st century.
Oh, she absolutely did. So for your listeners who aren't familiar with her, and by the way, you're certainly not alone. I did a poll of Twitter followers and Facebook followers and my own students and even some of my colleagues, and many didn't know who she was or vaguely knew who she was. There are very few who really had sort of committed Noether's theorem to memory, or really understood it, and she's incredibly important. So first, just a quick biography. She's an almost exact contemporary of Einstein. She was not allowed to study at Erlangen, which was the university in her town in Bavaria, actually where her father was even on the faculty. She was only basically allowed to audit classes and had to take a final exam remotely, sort of on her own, a final at the end of her 4 years of education, entirely because she was a woman. Eventually, she'd get her PhD. Having done so, she was invited to Göttingen University to work on her mathematics by some of the giants of the age. But again, because she was a woman, she wasn't there in any official capacity. She wasn't paid. She was allowed to lecture only under somebody else's name. But she produced this incredible, incredible body of work. Mathematicians, I think, revere her. But she's also produced something incredibly important for physicists, and that's this Noether's theorem. And Noether's theorem basically says all these symmetries that I talk about throughout the book, they have real consequences in the real universe. They create conservation laws. And conservation laws are physicists' bread and butter, and they can be explained very simply. You know, suppose you have $50 in your wallet, you spend $10 on lunch, you don't need to look in your wallet again to know how much money you have left, right? The money you took adds up to, and the money that remains adds up to what you started with. And the same is true for lots and lots of quantities like energy, momentum, electric charge. And what Noether did is she basically gave a way of computing, of figuring out what all of the conserved quantities in the universe are. And so if you come up with a new theory, and people do this all the time, people are trying to merge, you know, come up with so-called theories of everything and grand unified theories. If you come up with one of these theories, you basically, they're all built around symmetries. And so Noether basically says, here is exactly how you can figure out all the conserved quantities. It sort of provides the pathway to figuring out new particles, new interactions, and all of that. And it really just stems from this very basic idea that she came up with and developed. Incredibly, incredibly important. And it's an incredible shame that I think she's not better known.
History is certainly full of people who do important things like that that we then build on. But it seems like this was so important and yet not recognized.
It's hard to understand entirely why. I mean, part of it is she died quite young. You know, also, of course, the gender played a huge role in it. And I think there's also, I mean, obvious comparisons can be made with Einstein. Einstein, of course, early in his career was unrecognized. You know, he was working in the patent office until he had his great breakthroughs. But I mean, there's also a different style to their writing. I mean, Einstein wrote his papers in such a way to say, hey, I had this great idea. Let me explain it to you as I understood it. And he really does. He walks you through it sort of step by step by step. Noether, I think, in many respects, was such a genius that she said, look, you know, I'm assuming other mathematical geniuses are going to be reading this. So here's the math, and good luck to you.
Yeah, which would have left me out completely.
I got to tell you, I find it very, very difficult to read her papers as well. I mean, they're not even just written for scientists. They're written for mathematicians.
Right. Well, I have to say it is a wonderful book, Dave. I really appreciate the attention that you put into it and the fact that you managed to reference a lot of science fiction and Comic-Con and a few other things that I have to say you made me laugh out loud when you said you started a paragraph with, you know, when you watch Star Trek, parentheses, and you did.
Well, hopefully I know my audience.
Dave Goldberg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Dave Goldberg's latest book is called The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. He teaches in the physics department at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and his other works include A User's Guide to the Universe. He spoke with Bonnie North.